Next thing I want to do then is to put some meat on the bones of the concept of outrage. This slide represents the 12 principal components of outrage. Those of you who can't read the slide, you have this in your handouts. And if you're trying to follow in the handouts in the order in which I'm speaking, the handout should be in the right order, but I don't guarantee that I won't add things or skip things. But I will try, for those of you who like to use the handouts, to follow the same structure as the handouts and to keep you informed where we are, and where we are right now is there. And this slide, by the way, you'll notice is copyrighted 1991. Okay, 19 years ago. I think that's the date I made the slide as well, and I might want to spring for a new transparency. But I haven't found any need to revise the slide. I mean, these factors seem to not to change over time. And I would argue that what's on this slide is as true today as it was in 1991. The two columns are labeled safe and risky rather than low outrage and high outrage in order to dramatize my conviction that low outrage is one way of being safe and high outrage is one way of being risky. Obviously, low hazard is a different way of being safe. High hazard is a different way of being risky. But I am explicitly arguing that outrage is part of risk. It is not a misperception of risk. It's an actual part of risk, which then causes a misperception of the other part of risk. That is, outrage is the part of risk that may make you misperceive hazard. But it's not a misperception of the risk. It is a part of the risk. Okay, so the factors that are listed here are the factors that strike me as most important and that the research suggests are most important in determining how high the outrage will be. A risk that is voluntary, natural, familiar, not memorable, not dreaded, and so on down the safe side of the list is going to leave people calm even if it kills them. A risk that's coerced, industrial, exotic, memorable, dreaded, and so on down the risky side is going to upset people even if it's extremely unlikely to hurt them. Okay. These are the factors that add up to what I'm calling outrage. So you can use a list like this in a variety of ways. You can use it to predict outrage. So if you're about to open up a facility or you're about to buy another company, and you're considering whether this is a good project, whether this is a good purchase, a good acquisition, you can do an outrage assessment, an outrage due diligence, just as you do other kinds of assessments and due diligence before you make a purchase or launch a project. You can ask yourself, how much outrage am I buying into? And you can do that pretty straightforwardly by asking yourself, gee, is this situation voluntary or coerced, natural or industrial, familiar or exotic, and so on down the list. And you can get a fairly decent seat-of-the-pants prediction of how likely this is to arouse outrage in the populations that you're interested in. And again, seems to be culturally very broad. This is going to work just as well in one part of the world as in another. As far as we've been able to tell so far, there's very little adjustment that needs to be made to these factors in responding to local conditions. You can also use this not just to predict outrage, but to manage outrage. You begin to ask yourself, there's a question. Yes?
Are these intended to be in some order, or is it just conveniently labeled?
Good question. The question is, are these intended to be in an order, or is this just a 1 to 12 label? They were once in an order that I thought was heuristic when I lectured them one at a time, and I would start with voluntariness and end with responsiveness, and it made sense. But it's there, for our purposes today, they are not in any order. They're certainly not in order of importance. Generically, any of these 12 can be the dominant factor in a particular controversy. But the ones on this list that are most often, I think, the dominant factor are number 8, control, number 11, trust, and number 12, responsiveness. Across thousands of controversies, you know, you're probably likelier to have a control problem and a trust problem and a responsiveness problem than the other nine. And these aren't all that exist. There are actually 30 or 40. I just think these 12 are likelier to be the 800-pound gorilla than the other, you know, 28 or so. So these are not all the factors. They're the dominant factors, and they're not in order of importance. I should also emphasize that this list implies that these are equally important, but it also implies that they're dichotomous, and they're not. You know, you can't be a little bit pregnant, but a project can be less voluntary or more voluntary. It can be less familiar or more familiar. Most of these are better thought of as you know, 5-point scales with points in the middle than as dichotomies. Okay. But even if you make the simplifying assumption that they're dichotomous, you make the simplifying assumption that there are only 12, and you make the simplifying assumption that they are equally important, all false assumptions. Even if you make those three assumptions, you can still use a tool as simple as this to get a rough estimate of how much trouble you're buying, how likely the situation you're looking at is to blow up in your face as an outrage problem. Okay, I think what I want to do with this before we move past it is to practice it a little bit. Let's do a quick outrage assessment, and we're gonna not do it on a Rio Tinto problem. We may have occasion to do that tomorrow with some of the specific situations that we discuss. But let's do it with a problem that doesn't arouse, you know, any defensiveness in anybody in the room. We're going to assess the outrage of genetically modified food. I got up this morning, and as I was eating my breakfast, I read in the newspaper that there are genetically modified ingredients in my breakfast cereal. That was news to me. This is all hypothetical. That was news to me. I was shocked to learn that I am eating Frankenfood. I am eating genetically modified food. And the question that we're going to consider, independent of whether you think genetically modified food is high hazard or low hazard, because outrage is independent of hazard. So put the hazard aside, and what we want to do is calculate the likelihood that discovery that I'm eating genetically modified ingredients is going to provoke outrage in me. Okay, that's the question we're considering. So is my exposure to genetically modified food voluntary or coerced? Coerced. Okay. We could make it voluntary, right? Labeling would make it voluntary. If there were a mutant and a non-mutant aisle in the supermarket, then those who chose to shop in the mutant market, in the mutant aisle, would be voluntarily exposing themselves to genetically modified ingredients. But we don't have that choice. There isn't a label that tells us whether there are or are not genetically modified ingredients. So we're batting 0 for 1. Natural or industrial? Industrial. It's actually worse than industrial. I mean, we're pretending these are dichotomies, but if these weren't dichotomies, there are two industries that go beyond industrial to being profoundly unnatural, and one of those is relevant to some of you. One is the bioengineering industry, and the other is the nuclear industry. One invents creatures God never thought of, and the other invents elements God never thought of. So those two industries are as unnatural as it gets. But industrial will do. Familiar or exotic? Exotic. Very strange. Memorable or not memorable? Is the idea of genetic modification and mutants run amok, is that memorable or not so memorable? Memorable. Yeah. Where does the memorability come from? What made it memorable? Where did we get out most of our experience with genetic modification? Movies, absolutely. It comes from fiction, starting with Frankenstein, working its way through to Jurassic Park, Killer Tomatoes, and so on ad nauseum. We all have a vivid image in our mind that if there are scientists gene splicing in the first reel, there will be monsters run amok in the third reel. Okay. Those of you who don't know what a reel is, see me during the break, and I will explain that technology. So it is indeed memorable. Dreaded or not dreaded? Dreaded. It's a bad way to die, eaten by your breakfast cereal. We'd rather be in an automobile accident. Chronic or catastrophic? Now, this is an interesting one. The hazard is as chronic as hazard gets, right? I mean, you're eating a little bit more of this stuff every day. But I just read about it this morning in the newspaper. So my experience of the risk is catastrophic. Right? This is like groundwater contamination, which some of you have to deal with. Groundwater contamination is certainly a chronic hazard. You know, it moves at glacial speeds. But the day that you discover that your groundwater is contaminated is a catastrophic day. So as a communication issue, it tends to be a catastrophic one.
Half the bowl is in your stomach by the time you've read the packet.
Yes, half the bowl is in your stomach by the time you've read the packet, exactly. So we're still batting a perfect high outrage score here. Knowable or unknowable? Knowability is partly detectability, it's partly uncertainty, it's partly expert disagreement. So are those three high or low for genetically modified food? Yeah, they're high, so the knowability is low. It's a very unknowable risk. Okay. The particular problem there is expert disagreement, and it is at many of the sites that you work at, and expert disagreement is the worst kind of knowability. There was a study, for example, some years ago using EMFs, electromagnetic fields from transmission lines, as the case in point. And what they did is they wrote two news articles about EMF risk. In one article, all the experts quoted said it's pretty risky. Let's say 7 on a hypothetical 10-point scale. In the other article, half the experts said it's pretty risky, and the other half said, nah, not very risky, maybe 2 or 3 on the scale. Okay. And everybody read only one of the two articles, randomized as to which one they read, and then they were asked outrage-related and hazard perception-related questions. How upsetting is this? Would you buy a house with a transmission line going through its backyard? And a variety of questions to measure which of these two articles provoked more outrage. Okay. And what they found is that the second one provoked more outrage than the first one. Okay. And if you think about that for a minute, it's not crazy. If all the experts say it's 7, they know what they're doing, it's probably 7. If half say 7 and half say 3, obviously they don't know what they're doing, it might be 14. Moreover, if they all say 7, they'll probably do something to manage it. If half say 7 and half say 3, they will argue about it for another generation, and there's not going to be any hazard mitigation. So we all have an algorithm in our heads that says expert disagreement is a sign of trouble. And when experts are criticizing each other, the public gets more outraged. So much so that you can often reduce outrage by agreeing with your opponents. There are often reasons why you can't agree with your opponents, like a bright line legal standard or where you can't agree they're right. And as a matter of ethics, you probably don't want to agree they're right if you're convinced that they're wrong. But in terms of outrage, that pissing match between experts, where one side says I eat it for breakfast and the other side says even thinking about it will give you cancer, generates a lot of outrage. Okay. Number eight, individually controlled or controlled by others. Who controls my exposure to genetically modified food? Others. Now, again, labeling would solve that. In this case, voluntariness and control are going hand in hand. They're conceptually different. Voluntariness is who decides and control is who implements. It's quite possible to keep them separate, but in the case of genetically modified food, they are working together. Because the food's not labeled, my exposure is not voluntary, and I can't control it. Fair or unfair? The fairness is mostly about the distribution of risk compared to the distribution of benefit. Who gets the benefit from genetically modified food? manufacturers, the companies, you know, arguably perhaps the farmer, that's hotly debated, but there aren't very many identifiable consumer benefits for genetically modified food. So the consumer is bearing the risk and somebody else is getting the benefit. And therefore, the risk is unfair. Let me use fairness to make sure the causal system here is clear. Okay, with regard to genetically modified food, the risk is the benefits are not distributed in proportion to the hazard. Therefore, the risk is unfair. Therefore, the risk is high outrage. Therefore, I am inclined to think it's high hazard, even if it isn't. Now, compare that, for example, to genetically modified pharmaceuticals. Nearly all the diabetics in the developed world use genetically modified insulin rather than natural insulin. It's much higher quality. It's much less expensive. Even if you're, an organic food fan, you are going to use genetically modified insulin because, it's just enormous benefits over natural insulin. Okay. So now compare that then. With regard to genetically modified insulin, the benefits are going to the same people as the risk is. Therefore, it's fair. Therefore, it's low outrage. Therefore, I'm inclined to think it's low hazard, whether it really is or not. Okay. So independent of the actual hazard, genetically modified food is going to feel more hazardous to people than genetically modified pharmaceuticals because one is fair and the other is unfair. Does everybody follow that logic? That's the same logic for all 12 of these. Yes? Yes, the question is if it were clearly cheaper, would that change the equation? And the answer is yes. It might or might not determine finally the perception of fairness, but it would certainly alter the calculation. Much would depend on whether, if I decided it's genuinely cheaper and naturally cheaper and that's a genuine product advantage, it's going to make the benefit portfolio higher and therefore the outrage lower. If on the other hand I think you are temporarily and intentionally making it cheaper in order to suck me into doing something that will kill my children, I may actually get outraged at this strategy of giving me a short-term benefit. So things can get complicated, and I might reject that benefit as a trap. But all things being equal, price is one of the things that affects benefits, and therefore one of the things that affects the fairness of the risk. Other comment? All right, we're still batting 1,000. Morally relevant or morally irrelevant? Is this just an issue of safe versus dangerous, or is this also an issue of good versus evil? Good versus evil. The Catholic Church, for example, tends to oppose genetic modification on moral grounds as hubristic, as taking on a role that should be reserved for God. And similarly, virtually all pollution issues are moral issues as well as hazard issues. The very word pollution is a moral word. The church used it long before environmentalists used it. It applied to things like masturbation. And environmentalists borrowed the word pollution from the Catholic Church. They haven't returned it. And the reason they borrowed it is precisely because it's such a morally loaded term. So whenever you talk about pollution, you're not just talking about hazard, you're talking about morality. And of course, the same is true of lots of social impacts. I mean, there's a lot of moral issues lurking underneath what we want to interpret as hazard issues. Jody?
And Peter, I just want to point out that some of the words that we use technically translate in your audience's minds into words that have to do with pollution. So when we say polished water or pond water, and we know that it's perfectly safe or perfectly clean for the purpose that it's going to be used, still the fact that it's been recycled in some cultures suggests that it is and has been polluted, even though it's crystal clear. So we've seen that, for instance, in Greenfield's mines in Ghana, where perfectly safe, wonderful water was being discharged into local streams, but it was considered pollution by the people, the local tribes who were going to use that water.
Number 11 is trustworthy sources versus untrustworthy sources. Can you trust the people who secretly put genetically modified ingredients in your food and didn't tell you about it? The question obviously answers itself. The genetic modification industry made a conscious, intentional decision not to be trustworthy. They thought that there was no business model that permitted them to be trustworthy. They would have to lie in order to get these ingredients adopted. So they have paid and continue to pay a very high outrage cost for having made that decision. Many of you know the ways in which the mining industry is justifiably mistrusted because of a heritage, a long heritage of mistreating the people who were there before you were. And that mistrust is certainly a big piece of the outrage portfolio of virtually all the controversies you're now embroiled in. And finally, responsive process versus unresponsive process. And this is a kind of a catch-all category. It includes things like, do they listen when you're talking? Do they respond to you when you ask them a question? And, you know, are they respectful rather than contemptuous? All those kinds of relationship issues. And I have to give the genetic modification industry credit for this one. They used to be a perfect 12, which is why I like using them as an example. In recent years, they really have started responding much more appropriately to their critics. And I think I have to now give them credit for responsiveness. So now they're an 11 rather than a 12. But, you know, the conclusion to be drawn from this exercise is, you know, if you're thinking about going into the business of genetic modification, think twice because you're taking on something that is potentially very high outrage. That doesn't mean it necessarily will blow up in your face. It means it's not unlikely to blow up in your face. So maybe the conclusion you draw is don't go there, don't go into that business. Or maybe the conclusion you draw is go there, but do it slowly, do it gently, have an outrage management strategy in mind. And implement that outrage management strategy. Certainly, you know, with a high outrage situation, you would want to say, don't go blundering in as if outrage weren't a significant deterrent and a significant problem for that industry. The other conclusion is if you're an activist group looking for a nice, juicy issue to capitalize on, this is a good one.